lined up in rows and why there are bells. It's a factory model. The problem with that is that now people's careers basically have to be self-determined, but that's never part of the education system. Part of the reason I developed these programs was because I realized this is the same course where I'm teaching students that if they would have been in Germany in the 1930s, they would have been Nazis. I'm trying to get them to design their lives. And it's way better to have someone articulate their own plan. You actually neurologically rewire people by having them formulate their own thoughts, which is why, you know, your school teachers used to say, put it in your own words. It's actually very good advice if they would explain what that means. It's like, if you have to conjure up the thoughts and you have to articulate them, then they change you. And so, well, and so this program has had the effects have been absolutely overwhelming for us as researchers, because it's very, very difficult to produce an intervention that actually has a positive effect on people. You know, you hope it does, but generally when you test it out, it's like, nah, it doesn't do what you thought it did, or sometimes it even has the reverse effect.
That sounds fascinating. Now, can a regular person have access to this?
It's called self-authoring. So that's S-E-L-F, authoring, like writing a book, selfauthoring.com. And the programs, I gave away the future authoring program. I think it might still be free. It is till the end of November. I did a video called Message to Millennials, because one of the things Jonathan Haidt said about, he called Karl Marx the patron saint of the social justice warriors, and John Stuart Mill the patron saint of people, say, who stood for objective truth and freedom of expression. And I thought that was really smart. He said Brown University is number one for social justice warrior universities and Chicago for truth universities. But one of the things that Marx has over John Stuart Mill is that Marx is a social revolutionary, and young people like to think about ways to change the world, right? And that's actually a positive part of their development. It's a stage that the developmental psychologist Jean Piaget called the messianic stage, and he associated that with late adolescence. It's like, well, young people want to change the world. The problem is that that's been harnessed into attempts to change other people. But that isn't what you should do. If you want to change the world, you should change yourself. And I don't mean that in some cliched sense. I mean it in the sense that Alexander Solzhenitsyn said when he analyzed the Soviet Union. He said, don't be thinking that the line that divides good from evil runs down a political spectrum or countries or something like that. It runs down right down the middle of your soul. And if you want to sort out the world, then what you do is you sort yourself out. It's a serious business, right? They say it's more difficult to rule yourself than to rule a city. And that's the truth, because you're complicated and there are horrible monsters inside of you that need to be tamed and to be brought into alignment and submission so that you can be a powerful and useful person. And I gave away the future authoring program as part of this video I made suggesting to millennials that instead of rushing out there to change the world by changing other bad people, that they should look inward and sort themselves out properly. And I think we've given away about 4,000 or 5,000 of those programs so far.
Now, you said it's free till the end of November, and then what happens with it?
The future authoring program is regularly $14.95, and the whole self-authoring suite, which involves, it's a program that helps you write an autobiography, so it helps you sort out things about your past that are still burdening you. You can tell, if you have a memory that's more than 18 months old, approximately, and when you pull that memory up to mind, if you still have an emotional reaction, that means you haven't fully articulated the memory. You haven't analyzed it causally. You haven't freed yourself from its grasp, and you're carrying it like a weight. And your brain responds to that. Like, the more weight you're carrying like that, more baggage, let's say, the more of the stress hormone cortisol your brain produces. And cortisol makes you old. Some of this work has been done by James Pennebaker at the University of Texas at Austin, because he started to pioneer these sorts of writing programs. And he found that if people wrote about uncertain things, past, present, or future, so they could be traumatic things, they could be uncertain things, that their physical health improved. And he did a lot of detailed research trying to figure out why that was, and basically came down to the explanation that it was something like an uncertainty reduction mechanism at work. Because your brain is always figuring out how well situated are you in the world. how much do you not know compared to how much have you mastered? And you can tell that you've mastered things because when you go somewhere and you act, things turn out the way you want them. That's an indication of mastery. And your brain is sort of keeping track across your whole life of how many places you've been where things haven't worked out compared to how many places you have been where they have worked out. And if all those places in your past where things haven't worked out, you need to map and master. And that decreases the existential load on you, but that actually decreases your psychophysiological load. It makes you healthier. It Wow. makes you less stressed. And so we've put all that together in this self-authoring suite to help people write about their past, to sort it out in a detailed autobiography. It asks you questions about your past. It says, divide your life up into six epochs, and then divide each of those. That might be, say, birth to kindergarten, and then maybe elementary school, and then maybe junior high school, however you want to do it. And then to write about the emotionally significant events in each of those epochs, and then to describe their effects on you, and then to analyze how you did in those situations, what you might have done differently, what you might have do differently in the future, to straighten out your past. And I've done that with my students in my Maps of Meaning class for about the last 10 years, and some people have written 15,000 words. It's not that uncommon for students to write 15,000 words in their autobiography.
Wow.
So
that's such great advice. That's such great advice about reconciling with your past, because so many people just carry it around.
Yeah, well, if you're thinking about your past, what it means is you haven't analyzed the causal chains. Because you might say, well, why do you remember your past? Well, you might say, well, it's in order to have an objective, you know, record of the past. It's like it has nothing to do with that. There's only one reason you remember the past, and that's to be prepared for the future. That's why you remember the past. And so what you're supposed to do is take the past and extract out from it wisdom. And wisdom is the ability to avoid stumbling blindly into ditches. And so you think, well, here's a time in my past I stumbled blindly into this horrible ditch and terrible things happened to me. It's like, okay, you need to take that apart. You need to figure out how was it that events conspired with your participation, voluntarily or involuntarily, so that terrible consequence emerged. You need to know why that happened and how you could react differently in that situation. And as soon as you do that, your brain will leave it alone. It won't obsess you about it anymore, because the anxiety-producing parts of your brain are basically trying to tell you where there are obstacles in your environment. It's like, look out. Don't go there. Don't go there. It's like, well, don't go there. There's fire. Well, maybe you could master the fire, right? Then you're a wielder of fire. You're not just a victim. And lots of situations are dangerous or not dangerous depending on your level of mastery, right? I mean, life is like that. And so a negative emotion that's associated with a memory is something that's crying out for mastery, and writing can really help with that. So you're reorganizing your brain when you write autobiographically. You're basically, the emotions, imagine emotion, memories can be stored at different levels of your brain, from sort of primordial, reptilian, image-laden areas that are very emotional, up to finely articulated plans for your future life. Well, you want to take everything that's negative and emotional and transform that into a fully articulated vision for your future. And that frees you of your past. You shouldn't be thinking about your past. I mean, maybe if you're 80 and, you know, you're going over a well-spent life, that's a whole different thing. But if you're 30, 35, or 20, and most of the time you're thinking about your past, it's like your soul is trapped back there. And you need to free it through investigation. And the metaphysical language is appropriate, because that is, in a sense, what you're doing. You're trapped in the past. It's like you got to break free of that so you can use all your resources to move ahead into the future. Anyways, in these programs, the Future Authoring Program, like I said, has had walloping effects on people.
That's fantastic advice. I mean, it's just so it's so logical, and it sounds so great. I mean, I think that's one of the gigantic problems that a lot of people have with education, that you're learning facts, you're learning Yep. information, but you're not learning how to use your own mind.
Yeah, well, here's something that's really interesting about that. So I spend a lot of time, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a religious person. I'm a deeply religious person. And
how do you reconcile those?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's that. And I've spent 40 years thinking about that. And for 20 of those years, I did almost nothing but think about that all the time. And I realized something, partly from reading Carl Jung. And what I realized was that even the fundamentalists have the wrong idea about religious truth. Religious truth is not scientific truth. Like the stories in Genesis, which are very old stories, maybe tens of thousands of years old, they're obviously not scientific theories because the people who wrote them weren't scientists. We didn't have science until about 500 years ago. So the idea that the stories in Genesis are scientific theories is just false on every possible front. And so then you might say, well, there's no other truth but scientific truth. It's like, well, wait a minute. That's not true. Because what scientific truth tells you is what things are. But genuine religious truth tells you how you should act. And those things are not the same. And so a great story, like a great novel, which is a quasi-religious construction because it's like a distillation of ordinary life into its most important elements, that's a map about how you should comport yourself in the world. And you might say, well, what do you mean by should? And because that's the question the moral relativists ask. And there's an answer to that, too, as far as I can tell. And I got this partly from reading Jean Piaget. So imagine that here's how you should act. You should act so that things are good for you like they would be for someone you're taking care of. But they have to be good for you in a way that's also good for your family. And they have to be good for you and your family in a way that's also good for society. And maybe even also good for the broader environment, if you can manage that. So it's balanced at all those levels. And then that has to be good for you and your family and society and the world right now and next week and next month and a year from now and 10 years from now. And so it's this harmonious balancing of multiple layers of being simultaneously. And that's a Darwinian reality, I would say. Your brain is actually attuned to tell you when you're doing that. And the way it tells you is that it reveals that what you're doing is meaningful. That's the sign that your nervous system is adapted to do this. It's adapted to exist, I would say, on the edge between order and chaos. And chaos is where things are so complex you can't handle it, and order is where things are so rigid that it's too restrictive. In between that, there's a place that's meaningful, where you're partly stabilized and partly curious, and you're operating in a manner that increases your scope of knowledge, so you're inquiring and growing, and at the same time, you're stabilizing and renewing you, your family, society, nature, now, next week, next month, and next year. And when you have an intimation of meaning, then you know you're there. And I can give you an existential demonstration of that. So imagine that each of these levels of existence, the way I just laid them out, are like patterns. They're patterns within patterns within patterns within patterns. And there's a way of making all that harmonious. That's what music models. That's why music is so meaningful. You know, you take a beautiful orchestral composition, and all the instruments are doing different things at different levels, but they all flow together harmoniously, and you're right in the middle of that as a listener, and it fills you with a sense of, it's almost like a sense of religious awe, even if you're a punk rock nihilist, you know? And the reason for that is because the music is modeling the manner of being that's harmonious. It's the proper way to exist, and religious writings in the deepest sense, so those are archetypal writings, are guidelines to that mode of being. So they're not true, like scientific truth is true. I think of them as hyper-true or meta-true. It's like we take the most true things about your life, and then we take the most true things about 10 other people's lives, and we amalgamate them into a single figure, and that would be like a literary hero. And then we take 1,000 literary heroes and we extract out from each of them what makes the most heroic person. That's a religious deity. That's what Christ is. He's a meta-hero. And that sits at the bottom of Western civilization. And his archetypal mode of being is true speech. That's the fundamental idea of Western civilization. And it's right.
Now, when you say, when you talk about this harmonious frequency that's achieved, how do you reconcile all the stories that were, like, say, in the Old Testament that were extremely violent or they're ridiculous? Like, who was the guy that they made fun of? These children made fun of him. So God sent a bear to kill the children because they made fun of him for being bald. Or there's a bunch of stories and ridiculous tales in the Bible that obviously have the hand of man on them. How do you separate those from the beautiful concepts that are outlined in religion, like, you know, treat everyone as if they are your brother, you know, love and let love. And
no, it's very difficult because it's all in the Old Testament, let's say. I mean, the Old Testament was obviously written by people who were deeply tribal.
Right.
Now, of course, we're also deeply tribal. And some of the problems that those people were trying to sort out was, well, how do you organize yourself within your own tribe justly and mercifully, and at the same time defend yourself against the barbarians who constitute other tribes?
Right.
Well, that was the problem that humanity was trying to solve when it was amalgamating all of its tribes, a process that obviously still hasn't finished. And some of the ways that you protect your own tribe rapidly become horrifying, and so many of the stories in the Old Testament that have to do essentially with tribal protection are immediately horrifying. But there's also a developmental pathway through the combination of the Old and New Testament that show, I would say, how that morality that was fundamentally tribal to begin with transformed itself over thousands of years into a morality that was that transcended tribal distinctions. And so part of the imposition of the New Testament onto the Old Testament was the imposition of a morality that transcended tribal morality onto a morality that was fundamentally tribal in origin.
But the New Testament, of course, was constructed by Constantine and a series of bishops. They took things out, they added things.
Yeah.
I mean, how... So,
well, it's not much different. Here's a way of thinking about it.
Okay.
So I have a friend who's a comic book writer, and I've talked to him a fair bit about archetypes in comics, for example. He was a student of mine at Harvard a long time ago. And the comic book universe is a very interesting one because, obviously, these fictional characters were thought up by single people, and then the fictional characters were transformed into stories, and then the stories were sent out into a broader community. But then what started to happen was the broader community started to stay in contact with the people who were writing the stories. And so if you do something like write Batman now, there's a bunch of things you can't do with Batman because there's been a collective decision made in the entire community of multiple writers and the entire community of multiple readers that have decided that there's a core story that has a certain structure and certain elements. And so there's this collective process of imagination that's gone into constructing what you might describe as a heroic meta-narrative. And the reason I'm using that as an example is because there isn't a lot of difference, perversely enough, in the construction, say, of comic book heroes and the construction of religious deities. And I'm not saying that religious deities are nothing but comic book characters. Or maybe I'm elevating comic book characters beyond the status that they normally attain. But if you think about this, for example, with regards to something like the construction of the recent Marvel universe, I mean, those Avenger movies are among the most expensive technological artifacts that human beings have ever made. And they drive our computational capacity to its absolute limit. And the reason for that is because we're using that fictional space to lay out an archetypal and mythological view of the universe. It's a practice domain for modes of being. And I mean, in the Marvel universe, obviously Tony Stark, Iron Man, is technological man, right? He's trying to develop a real relationship with his partner, Pepper Potts, who's, you know, her own sort of independent woman. And he's attempting to use technology to build himself up into something that has the status of approximately a god, to transcend mortal limitation and all of that. So there's a deity-like aspect, the growth of a deity emerging there. And then, of course, Thor and Loki, they're not comic book deities at all. They're actual deities. They're the hostile brothers. It's an archetypal pair, like Christ and Satan, or Batman and the Joker, or Superman and Lex Luthor. And that's the good part of the individual against the evil part of the individual, roughly speaking. That's played out in these myths. And so that collective process that you described, whereby an entire group of people comes together to decide what the central religious text is. I mean, on the one hand, you can think of that as the gerrymandering of a religious process. Maybe that's something that's only devoted towards the acquisition of power, like that would be a Marxist analysis. But on the other hand, you can think of it as the collective imagination attempting to build a dramatic, an exemplary drama that everyone can act out. And it's in acting out that exemplary drama that we are actually able to interact in a civilized and productive manner. Like, look at this discussion that we're having to the degree that it's working. We're both trying to articulate our notions of reality. And I do that, and you listen, and maybe you have some comments, and then you do that, and I listen, and maybe you have some comments. But together, we're building something that's different from what we both came in here with, right? And in a sense, what we're doing is we're participating in the process of articulating each other's spirits. And I mean that most technically. Like, part of your spirit is an amalgam of the information that you've encountered. A lot of that's articulated wisdom. And so it's soul construction. If you're having a good conversation, and that's also a conversation that is meaningful, and you can tell that when you're having it, it's that you're decomposing parts of yourself, your false presuppositions, you're letting them die, and you're letting something new be born as an alternative. And you're participating in this process of death and rebirth constantly when you're having a meaningful conversation. It's like, oh, that was wrong. I'm going to let that die. Ooh, that's a little painful. I was kind of attached to that concept, but I'll let it go. I'll let it burn off, and a new part of you will emerge. And then another part dies, and a new part emerges. And that's this process of eternal death and rebirth that's part of the general mythology of redemption. You see that all the time, too, in the Harry Potter series, for example. At the very end of the Harry Potter series, Potter undergoes a literal death and rebirth, and that's how he finally defeats evil. These stories are deeply built into people. There's a reason that J.K. Rowling became the richest person in England. She's richer than the Queen. She got rich by telling the story properly. You know, and the second volume of Harry Potter, when there's the basilisk underneath the castle that turns you to stone when you look at it, that's everything that people are afraid of. That freezes you like a rabbit freezes when it sees a wolf. And the story in Harry Potter is you go underneath the castle to where the thing that fear frightens you the most resides, and you face it down. And in doing that, you free the Virgin, right? That's St. George. He frees Virginia in the Harry Potter story. And maybe you half die because of that, because he gets bitten by that basilisk and just about dies. And then it's the phoenix that saves him, because the phoenix is the spirit of death and rebirth. These stories, they come up everywhere. There's no avoiding them. And it's because they're true. But they're not true like scientific truths. They're a behavioral truth, if or a pragmatic truth, or a dramatic truth. And part of the reason that our society is so damn unstable now, and part of the reason all this weird chaos is emerging, this is a consequence of Nietzsche's observation back from the late 1800s about the death of God. We blew the metaphysical foundations out from underneath our culture. And the whole thing is shaking and twisting. And it's vacillating between the horrors of the extreme right and the horrors of the extreme left. It's been doing that for 140 years, and we're in the throes of that again. We blew the metaphysical foundations out from underneath our culture, and we need to get them back. Part of the reason that people are so obsessed by things like the Avengers movies and the superheroes and Harry Potter and all of that is because, and Star Trek and Star Wars, is because our collective imagination is trying to regroup at the level of drama and reformulate our fundamental metaphysics.
I was reading this thing that was talking, they were equating CrossFit and yoga to religion. And they were saying it's essentially religion for people that have abandoned traditional religions. And that the idea is that what we're seeking is camaraderie, order, and
discipline.
Discipline. Mm-hmm. And some sort of a shared community experience. So when you're talking about, when you're saying your religion, you're not talking about a literal translation, like a guy actually came back from the dead. What you're talking about is the concepts and the thoughts and the harmonious frequency that is achieved when people follow the tenets of that religion and live by these laws, as you're saying, of stacking on these ideas. Is this good for you? Is it good for the community? Is it good for the community in 5 years, in 10 years? That's what you're saying when you're talking about your belief in love of religion.
But the other thing about that is that, like, imagine that there's a pathological mode of being that's so terrible that when you enact it, you just die. A good drug addiction will do that for you if you pursue that. Meth addiction, pursue that for about 10 years, you know, and you'll descend to the lower levels of hell and then you'll die. Right. Well, so then you might say, well, what's at the opposite end of that? What would be the final manifestation of a mode of life that was revivifying and healthy? How redemptive and rejuvenating would that be? And I would say the answer to that is that we don't know. We have no idea. And these ideas of death and rebirth are definitely true on the micro level. Like, so the developmental psychologist Piaget said, for example, that when you incorporated new information, however you did that, learning or conversation, that new information would exist in contradiction to something that you already presumed. And so that thing you presumed would have to disintegrate and die. And then something new would be born. That can happen at different levels of analysis. So sometimes you learn something minor. And sometimes you're shook to your bloody core, you know, and you undergo a descent into the underworld fundamentally, sometimes even a descent into hell. That's where you get genocidal and resentful. And then maybe you're lucky and you pop up reborn. Well, those exist as constant metaphysical truths. That's how human beings transform. And we don't know the upper limits of that transformation. We have no idea what that might be. Because I don't know, for example, how healthy you could be if you were as healthy as you could be. If you straightened yourself out completely, I don't know what limits you could transcend, and neither does anybody else. So we don't know the upper limits of the truth of these religious stories. Now, we do know what happens if you let go of them too badly. You end up with something like the Soviet Union or Mao's China.
Which were both based on, I mean, they were atheist.
Yeah, they were secular. They were, they dispensed, you know, for Marx, religion was the opiate of the masses. It's not like I don't understand that. I understand that. But it's another one of those situations where it's like religion is the opiate of the masses. Yeah, and it's also 50 other things. Mm. And you don't want to forget those. Like, really, we know, for example, from anthropological studies, religious belief is a human universal. And the reason for that, in part, is because there is a distinction between good and evil. And there is a distinction between good and bad. Otherwise, you wouldn't do anything. Like, you're always striving for the good. I mean, unless you've taken a malevolent turn. It's a natural impulse in human beings to make what is better. Well, it means we have a deeply inbuilt sense of what constitutes better.
And we're all aware of that harmonious state that's achieved in community.
And the thing that's interesting about it, like one of the things that Nietzsche thought was after he announced the death of God was that people would be able to create new values. And Carl Jung took issue with that. He was a student of Nietzsche's, and he pointed out basically that, well, wait a minute. Who says you can create your own values? You can't even get yourself out of bed to go exercise in the morning. You're not under your own control. Maybe we could rediscover the values that we once held. And that's the descent into the underworld and the resurrection of the father. That's what happens in Pinocchio, for example. You know, when Pinocchio goes down into the depths to face Monstro and revitalize his dead father. There's a reason that movie was made in the 1930s and why it was so popular. It's like, you want to get rid of your damn strings and stop being a neurotic jackass. That's what the story's about, is you go down to the bottom of the ocean, you find the thing you're most afraid of, you face it, you rescue your dead father from the depths, and you rise back to the surface with him. That's what our culture has to do. That's what our culture has to do.
Now, when you say that you're a religious person, though, people automatically assume that there's, especially in this country, the religious right, there's a very dogmatic and very simplistic view of what God wants, and it's lumped into no homosexuals, certain restrictions on the behavior of women. If you look at the Bible, and the Bible is obviously a reflection of the people that lived at the time where it was constructed, although even trying to figure out when that is, you know, it was an oral tradition for thousands of years before it was ever written down, written in ancient Hebrew, translated to Latin and Greek and Roman, or in English, rather.
Well, there's always a tension in religions between the dogmatic element and the spiritual element.
Right.
And conservatives, technically speaking, tend to marshal themselves on the sides of the more rule-oriented and dogmatic elements of the religion, and liberals, roughly speaking, tend to marshal themselves more on the spiritual side.
And that's because of the distinction that you were saying earlier about the behavior patterns of people that tend to be conservative versus...
Yeah, it's conscientiousness versus openness, roughly speaking. And, I mean, the dogmatic structures are necessary. The dogma is necessary because it conserves the structure. But the spiritual aspect is necessary because it updates the structure. And there's always this tension, and there's a tension in people. It's like you have to believe things or you couldn't exist, you couldn't act. You have to hold on to the dogmatic structure of your belief, but you have to be open for its update on a continual basis. And that's basically what consciousness is for. That, seriously speaking, consciousness is the thing that attends to the unknown and to the anomaly and integrates it with the structure. And there's meaning to be found in that, too. That's to boldly go where no one has gone before, you know, in the words of the Star Trek writers. And something that deeply appeals to young people when they watch that sort of thing.
You're listening to Jordan Peterson on his first appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience in November 2016. Now back to the show.
So what the fundamentalists are doing is they're trying to hold on to their tradition. And it's no bloody wonder, because if the tradition falls apart, you end up isolated and drowning in the ocean alone. But if the tradition gets too intense and restricted, well, then you're just clones in a prison. And that's these two forms of hell. In a sense, they meet, you know, if they get extreme enough, they meet. The hell of absolute chaos and the hell of absolute order. And the conservatives tend towards the hell of absolute order, and the left liberal types tend towards the hell of absolute chaos. There's some point in the middle. That's the line between yin and yang, by the way, because that's order and chaos. And the Taoists say, well, that's life, that's existence, order and chaos. And order is the place you are when what you do works, and chaos is where you are when what you do doesn't work. And no matter where you go, order and chaos exist, and your job is to be right on the border between those. And that's to live in Tao, that's to live in meaning, and that's that same place where all these things stack up. And so with regards to religious tradition, on the one hand, you have to maintain the tradition. It's like maintaining the Constitution in the U.S. On the other hand, you have to be awake and alert because the tradition is a dead thing, right? It was composed by dead people in the dead past. It can't respond as flexibly as it should to the demands of the present. That's up to you, and you do that with your vision, with your capacity to see, and with your capacity to articulate. And forever, really. The major deities that mankind have produced, Marduk for the Mesopotamians and Osiris or Horus for the Egyptians and Christ for the Christians and Buddha for the Buddhists, these have been people who were noted for their vision, for their ability to watch and pay attention, because there's nothing more important than the ability to pay attention. Pay attention and speak the truth, your truth, and that's how you keep everything stacked up in order harmoniously. That's how you keep the balance between order and chaos. That's how you articulate your being. That's how you revivify the world. That's how you rescue your dead father from the bottom of the ocean. That's how you adopt your responsibility as a citizen. That's how you live a proper life. And a proper life, I know what a proper life is, because I've thought about this for a long time. Life is suffering. And suffering can make you resentful, murderous, and then genocidal, if you take it far enough. So you need an antidote to suffering. And maybe, you know, you could think, well, I'll build walls of luxury around myself and that'll protect me from the suffering. It's like, well, good luck with that, because that isn't going to work. And maybe you could build a delusion and live inside that, but that's going to fall apart. Well, what is there that helps you fight against suffering? That's easy. That's the truth. The truth is the antidote to suffering. And the reason for that is because the truth puts reality behind you so that you can face the reality that's coming straight at you without becoming weak and degenerating and becoming resentful and wishing for the destruction of being. Because that's the final hell. The final hell is your soul wishing for the destruction of everything because it's too painful and you're too bitter. And that happens to people all the time.
Now, as a person who is someone who's extremely critical of ideologies, a lot of people would think it's a contradiction for you to embrace religion, because religion being the biggest, ideology, the oldest ideology of all.
Ideology is a parasite on religious substructures. You can't, look, we could go back to the Harry Potter example. That's a good example. I mean, J.K. Rowling had kids reading like 400-page books, right? She could fill a stadium when she was reading. Why? Is because she got the archetypes right. She got the religious sub-narratives correct. They're not ideologies. Ideologies work because an ideology is a parasite on top of a religious substructure. And a religious narrative has a particular set of characteristics. It's very balanced. So, for example, there's the feminist idea of the patriarchy. Well, the religious idea of society has an evil patriarchy notion built into it. That would be the dying king, the once great dying king. You see this in the Egyptian story of Osiris, for example, who's eventually chopped up by his evil brother. You see it in the Lion King with Mufasa and Simba's father and Simba's evil uncle. Those are the two representatives of the patriarchy, the wise king and the tyrannical king. In a religious story, properly set up archetypal story, there's the natural world, the chaotic world, there's a positive element and a negative element. There's the social world, there's the wise king and the tyrannical king. And there's the individual world, and that's the adversary and the hero. There's always a positive and a negative at each level. And it stops it from being an oversimplification, because it says to you, well, of course bloody society is an oppressive patriarchy. But it's also the wise father that has taught you to speak every word you know. It's like, you don't get to say only this part of the story without having gratitude for this part of the story. And it's true at each level of the representation, a properly balanced story has got the balance between positive and negative always correct.
Is that in many ways like a lot of people who are anti-Western capitalism are also the only... They will find that capitalism, and Western capitalism in particular, is the only culture that has embraced the acceptance of people.
Yeah, right.
Like transgender people, people who are gay, people who are marginalized. Western capitalist society is one of the very few cultures that openly abhors racism.
Right, right, right. Well, and these people are anti-capitalist on their iPhones. Right, you don't get to do that. Right, it's a performative contradiction.
That's so important.
Yeah, they're on their iPhones while they're flying.
Yeah,
yeah. It's while like well, I'm anti-capitalist. It's like, well, actually, no, you're not. You're just deeply confused. That's what you are. Is deeply confused.
It's not capitalism that's the problem. It's evil that's the problem.
It's a deeper problem. Evil is a problem. So there's a religious scholar named Mircea Eliade who looked at flood myths, because there are flood myths all over the world. God gets fed up, floods everything. It's like just like in New Orleans. So here's a funny thing about New Orleans. What caused the New Orleans flood? Well, a hurricane.
No.
Yeah? No. How about human corruption? How about the corruption of the state? How about the fact that people knew the damn dikes weren't going to hold? That the levees weren't going to hold? How about that they knew that for 100 years and didn't care? How about that they pocketed the money that should have gone for the repair? And so in flood myths, you always see two things. You see that, I'm paraphrasing, say, there's a storm, there's dikes, and there's people responsible for maintaining the dikes. Well, a storm won't wipe out the city. It could. But if the dikes are high enough, then it won't. And if people aren't corrupt, then they build the dikes properly. And so God floods the world when the dikes have rotted and the people have become corrupt. And it's a very old story, and it's disseminated everywhere. And the reason is well, we inhabit a social structure that's old and dead. Our infrastructure is decayed. Our political, economic, and practical infrastructure has decayed. Well, why? It's old. Everything decays. Okay, everything's already always decaying. That's dangerous. And corrupt people don't do a very good job of keeping it in order. And so if things get old and decayed enough, and if people get corrupt enough, then God floods the world. Why? Because that's what happens. Over and over and over and over and over.
And you don't mean God in the literal sense of the word. You mean God as these are the consequences to these type of actions. You are not prepared
for what
you think.
Transcendent reality.
Right.
You could look at it that way. You know, and I mean, the idea of God is a very, very complicated idea, but you could say, if you were thinking about it merely from an intellectual perspective, is you could say that God is what transcends your knowledge. That's all. It's what you don't know. It's what's outside of your knowledge structures. And there's a very old story, and this goes all the way back to the Tower of Babel, is that one of the things that characterizes authoritarians is that there's never anything outside of their knowledge structures. They make their knowledge structures absolute. So in the Tower of Babel, human beings build this structure that's supposed to reach all the way to heaven. So that we can invade the place of the gods. Well, God has none of that. He just blows it apart and throws people all over the world. It's a very early, dramatic representation of the danger of human hubris. And the hubris is, we know everything. There's nothing that needs to be left outside of what we know. It's like, no, that's what God is. God is what's always outside of what you know.
Is the problem with the term God? Though the people think of God as being a man. They think of it being a person. They even use the masculine pronouns in reference to God. I mean, that's one of the funniest things about God is calling him a he.
Well, it's a problem. I mean, and that's certainly been a problem. Jung talked about that a lot, about the exclusion of the feminine within the domains of classic Judeo-Christian thought, for example. I mean, you have Mary, who's a kind of a quasi-deity, who pops in sort of like as a fourth member of the Trinity. But the exclusion of the feminine is definitely a conceptual problem. Is the fact that God is conceptualized as a human being or as a man a problem? It's a problem and a solution. I mean, if you remove the human element of God, then God gets so abstract that it's easy for him to float off into space and to never show up again. You lose the human connection. I mean, the way the Catholics solve that to some degree is that they have God, who's sort of at the top of the hierarchy, and then they have this hierarchy of saints who are sort of like gods but half human, and then they have human beings at the bottom. And that allows for a continual chain of communication between the highest level of abstraction and the actual concrete person. But the other thing that's useful about the conceptualization of God in anthropomorphic terms is that, and this is worth noting, is there is nothing more complex in the cosmos than a human being. So if you're looking for something to represent the ultimate in complexity, it's hard to beat a human being. So your brain is ungodly complicated, so to speak. So, I mean, these things are obviously too complicated to unpack in a.
Yeah, I didn't expect us to even get into this conversation, but I'm glad we did. Do you think that these stories exist because somewhere in our code, somewhere in our very being, we understand that there is a need for this order to find this frequency?
They're an expression of our deepest being. They're an expression of how it is that we must live in order to live,
in order to reach our full potential.
Even more than that.
More than that.
Even to avoid hell. And you can think of you can think about hell as Nazi Germany if you want. You can think about it as the Soviet Gulag Archipelago or Mao's Cultural Revolution. Like, we can get there, no problem. If you walk down in some of the seedier areas in L.A., you'll see people in hell, no problem.
Sure, go to Skid Row.
Yes. And you can tell when those people are there because they will get angry if you look at them. And you'll walk a big berth around them. You're not going to come within 10 feet of the, let's call it, psychogeography of their existence.
Mm.
Right. And that they're in a place. It's a metaphysical place, but it's not defined by the damn geography.
Right.
You know, Skid Row is as much of a psychological place as it is a physical place. In fact, it's more a psychological place, but that doesn't make it any less a place. And if you're descend into the hell of Skid Row deep enough, you'll get to the point where most of your thoughts are murderous. And that's like, that's hell as a suburb of the underworld, fundamentally. That place exists. People visit it all the time. And sometimes they don't get out. It's real.
I've been discussing this a lot recently because people like to talk about the concept of apocalypse, that we're headed towards an impending apocalypse. Oh. And my thought is that apocalypse is already here. It's just not right here.
Yeah, it's always here.
Go to Liberia. Go to Liberia and look at people defecating in the streets and eating human flesh. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the Vice piece on Liberia, but it's unbelievably terrifying how people live there.
The apocalypse is an archetypal idea, and the apocalypse is always here. And it's here at the micro level. Like, when we have a discussion and our concepts change, those are micro-apocalypses. Little bits of our being are being blown apart and restructured. And that can happen at a small scale or a large scale. Or it can get to the point where everything collapses and is destroyed. And life is apocalyptic in that matter because we all get sick. We all die. You know, our families are vulnerable. There's an apocalyptic element to being, and we have to face that and confront it and deal with it properly. And the wrong way to deal with it is to is to generate more hell than heaven, I suppose, and to do that consciously. And people do that all the time, too. There's never a situation that's so bad that there isn't something you can do to make it worse. And there's very seldomly a time when you're not motivated at some level of your being to put the knife in and twist it just one more quarter turn. People are like that. And we have reason. Life is hard. It's no wonder people get corrupted by it. It's not an easy thing to live in a... It's not an easy thing to live, let's say, in a truthful manner. But the alternative is hell. Part of the reason that I made these videos to begin with was because, you know, I learned a lot about the importance of spoken truth as the countervailing force against tyranny and authoritarianism. It isn't an alternative political structure that's the countervailing force. It's spoken truth that's the countervailing force. It's like, well, why would I put my job on the line to have an opinion about compelled pronouns? I know why. Because the ability to speak your truth is the bulwark against hell. And losing your job? That's nothing. That's nothing compared to where things can go when they go badly. For me, it was just preventative. It's like, this isn't going in a good direction. Well, should you take a risk? It's like, you don't have that choice. You're silent? That's a risk. Now, most people don't understand the risks of silence. I happen to understand the risks of silence because I've been studying them for 40 years.
Is it frustrating for you to get so little support for these actions and for your protests?
Well, I wouldn't say that that's what happened.
And I don't mean so little support, because you're getting a lot of support outside of the university.
It's okay. It doesn't matter where the support comes from. Like, I mean, it's disappointing in the same way that it's disappointing for me to say, I think the universities now do more harm than good. That's disappointing. But it doesn't, it's not surprising to me. Like, it isn't as if intellectuals are characterized by an intrinsic moral superiority. Oh, they're smart, so they'll leap to the defense of what's right. It's like, no, there's no evidence for that. Intelligence and moral wisdom aren't the same thing. Like, and if you're corrupt and smart, all that makes you is way more treacherous. It doesn't make you less likely to be corrupt. It just makes you much more, you're 50 snakes instead of two, or you're 56-headed snakes instead of two. Like, I've had clients who had very serious personality disorders, who were very intelligent. It's like, that's not necessarily a good thing for them. They're just better at arguing for their pathology to themselves.
That is a real problem, where people automatically assume that intelligent people are going to be healthy.
Yeah, well, they're healthy in that often they do better in the world, you know, because
more
their
successful.
Skills are, yes, their
right.
skills are more marketable and so on. But there's no evidence that there's any relationship between intelligence and morality. I mean, God, let me tell you a story, man. One time I had this client. This woman was just ruined. She looked like a street person, you know, and she had very dirty clothes. And she was so shy that she couldn't even approach you. She had to shield her eyes from you as if you were emitting light. And she did that to everyone on the street. Like, she was bent over and humble, like a Chinese peasant brought before the emperor, you know. And one of the things I was doing with her in behavior therapy was trying to just get her to present herself in a more normal manner so that people wouldn't shy away from her and, you know, be instantly prejudiced towards her. And she'd come to the behavior therapy clinic. And she wasn't bright, this woman. I think she had only had like a seventh grade education. She was quite intellectually impaired. And she lived with her sick aunt who was schizophrenic and who had a satanically possessed alcoholic boyfriend that was always tormenting my client. She lived in absolute hell. But she had this dog, and she used to take it out and walk the dog all the time. And then she'd actually come to the behavior therapy clinic, partly because of her own problem, but she'd come to this place called the Douglas Hospital, and she'd been an inpatient in the Douglas Hospital. And in the Douglas Hospital, there were these long-term psychiatric clients, and they looked like something out of a Hieronymus Bosch painting or Dante's Inferno. I mean, these people were, this is way worse than One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. These people were seriously destroyed, and they couldn't be let back out on the streets during deinstitutionalization. Like, they were lifers. And she had decided that part of the reason she wanted to come to the hospital was because she had been institutionalized there. And she thought that maybe when she took her dog out for a walk, she could go and get one of those damn inmates and take them out for a walk too. Now, that was a person who was immoral, dumb as a post, just screwed in 50 different directions, nothing going for her. And she had the bloody moral capacity to decide that there was someone worse off than her, and believe me, that wasn't easy to find, and that maybe she could do them some good if the hospital would let her, which they didn't, by the way. Yeah, well, that's the story of the soul. That's not the intellect, that's for sure. So I didn't expect any support from my colleagues. And it isn't that I don't care if I got it, but it's in some sense, it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant to me because my goal was, I'm not saying those goddamn pronouns. And the reason I'm not saying them is because they're made up by left-wing ideologues. And I don't like left-wing ideology. I don't like ideology, period. And I know where corruption of speech leads. And I'm not going there. And, you know, one of the things I tried to learn when I was taking apart what happened in Auschwitz and trying to put myself in the position of an Auschwitz camp guard, which, by the way, you can do if you use your imagination a bit. I wouldn't call it exactly the world's most pleasant meditative experience. But you can call up parts of yourself that would be capable of taking someone who just got off a transport train and having them carry a 100-pound sack of wet salt from one side of the camp compound to the other and back. You can conjure that part of yourself up if you want, and that'll teach you something about what you're like. People don't do it because it's too frightening. But I know perfectly well that I could do that sort of thing. And so once I learned that I could do that sort of thing, and maybe that I could even enjoy it, I thought, okay, fine, I get it. I'm going to see if I can figure out how to live so that if that opportunity was presented to me, I wouldn't take it. And I think that's the lesson that people need to learn from the 20th century. It's like, that's what human beings did, okay? Well, we're all human, okay? So how is it that we should live so that we don't do that again? Well, part of that is to try to say the truth, no matter what, because the alternative is worse, and it is worse.
The truth, no matter what, and that is the real problem that you see with being forced into using these made-up pronouns.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my language. I'll take responsibility for what I say. I am not saying your words.
And being compelled to say your words by law.
Well, that takes it past the point of absurdity to the point of tyranny, in my estimation.
And I've seen some criticisms where people are saying, you know, he's talking about this, but really he's grandstanding because no one's doing anything legally. But
oh, yeah,
the potential
right. Exists. Oh, that's such rubbish.
But that is one of the arguments.
Criminals. Yes, they wouldn't have changed the damn criminal. They put it in the hate speech category and altered the criminal code. It's as simple as that. And then you could say, well, no, we didn't really mean it. It's like, oh, yeah, you did. You really meant it. Two of the social justice warriors that have debated me in the last 2 months accused me directly of hate speech. All I had to do was poke them a tiny bit, and they came right out with it. And then the university's legal team reviewed everything I said carefully, believe me, and they decided that, oh, it was not only illegal to not use these compelled pronouns, it was probably illegal to make a video saying that I wouldn't use them. Because otherwise, why would they write me a warning letter and tell me that I violated university policy on the Ontario Human Rights Act? They did that lightly?
Have they acted on this at all?
Well, they won't. No. Well, they've acted in that they sent me two warning letters and told me to stop talking. And
but you don't.
The idea that I was going to be teaching in January again, because I teach all my undergraduate courses from January to May, that was on the table. And I think the only reason that it hasn't happened, one of the reasons it hasn't happened, and I'm not attributing nothing but malevolence to the university administration, because obviously it's very complicated, and they did agree to host the debate, for example. But the idea that I wouldn't be teaching in January, and still might not be, is by no means... That was a perfectly plausible outcome. And had this not caused a firestorm, much of which has emerged in support of me, then I would say there was a 50-50 chance that I would have had my teaching privileges revoked. It's happened to other professors. So the idea that I'm making it, like that this is a tempest in a teapot, it's like, Yeah, okay, fine. Why'd you change the criminal code then? And why'd you put it under the hate speech laws? Exactly. So, no, doesn't wash. And the fundamental proof of that is the university's response, because for sure their legal team crafted those letters. You know, it was like, recalcitrant employee, you're responsible for them. Okay, what do you do with a recalcitrant employee? You write them a letter telling them what they're doing wrong and asking them to stop. Then if they don't stop, you write them a second letter that's more strongly worded. Then if they don't stop, you write them a third letter, even more strongly worded. Then you take disciplinary action. That's like HR 101. That's how you do it. So
here we sit at the end of November, closing in on December. You're literally a bit more than a month away, and you don't know whether or not you're teaching your courses in January?
Sunshine State, yes, I'm going down to FLA. I'll play my music all over the place. Find myself a cutie with a pretty little face. Sunshine Highway, I'm on my way. Take me on down to FLA. Sunshine on east side, east side or west side, baby. Get me on down to the Sunshine State. From Gainesville to Largo, then bumper, bumper all the way. They got raisins and rednecks, the Riviera kind. From Key West to Largo, man, it takes all kinds. The sunshine's warm and the beer tastes fine. Come on down and get out of your mind. Sunshine Highway, I'm on my way. Take me on down to FLA. Sunshine on east side or west side, baby. Get me on down to the Sunshine State. From Gainesville to Largo, don't forget to tone them, man, it's always a gas. Get yourself a Harley and a sweet piece of that. And find yourself a bar where the people look mean. Come on down, glide on your old machine. Sunshine Highway, I'm on my way. Take me on down to FLA. Sunshine on east side or west side, baby. Get me on down to the Sunshine State. From Gainesville to Largo, the bumper bumper all the way. To the road, buy yourself a ticket that'll just up and move, and find yourself a payphone that doesn't have a line. Come on down and get out of your mind. Sunshine Highway, I'm on my way. Take me on down to FLA. Sunshine on east side or west side, baby. Get me on down to the Sunshine State. From Gainesville to Largo, the bumper bumper all the way. Yeah, from Gainesville to Largo, the bumper bumper all the way. Sunshine, New York City, the FLA. Get me on down to the Sunshine State.
Hey, this is Amanda Palmer and the Grand Theft Orchestra, and you're listening to WMFO Medford.
get.